Hello and welcome to My Biggest Lesson, the show that brings you the key learnings from the most influential founders, executives, and investors in the Colorado tech community. My name is Adam Burrows.
And I'm Chris Erickson. Together, we are the co-founders of Range Ventures,
an early stage venture firm based in Denver. You can find out more about what we're up to at range.vc. Our guest today is Devin Tavona, head of travel at Kuba Software. Devin was the founder and CEO of Panna, a travel software company that went through Techstars Boulder in 2015 and subsequently raised over $15 million on its way to being successfully acquired by Coupa earlier this year. I originally met Devin during the Techstars program 6 years ago and have always been impressed by his desire and determination to build not only a great product, but a great company culture as well, which you'll hear about in his biggest lesson.
Devin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Happy to. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. We'd love to hear a little bit about your background and what you're up to these days.
Yeah, definitely. So I, born and raised in Colorado, went to CU for school, and right out of school, had the really fortunate opportunity to not be burdened by a lot of debt from school. So, and always knew that I wanted to start a company, and so really found this as the perfect opportunity to try it. Went into business with a good friend of mine, Sam Felsenthal, who you should also have on this podcast. He's fantastic. And we started a company which went through a ton of different names, but ended with the name Panna. We raised about $12 million. We were building corporate travel software, so helping our customers spend their travel more wisely, make their travel dollars go further, and take care of their travelers on the road. And most recently, this February, we sold the business, kind of in the middle of the pandemic, opportunistically, to a company out of San Mateo called Coupa. They're about a $26 billion public company. They're a business spend management platform. So they handle everything from expense reports to invoices to procurement processes to sourcing processes for companies. And the one piece of spend that they didn't have their arms around was travel. So it was kind of a perfect fit. We were at a crossroads in the company that made sense to sell. And I think, you know, ultimately created a great outcome for everyone.
Well, huge congrats on that. Obviously, another win for the ecosystem. And so happy to see you and Sam and Darko and everyone there have so much success. A couple questions for you. One is the obvious question, Devin, of how did you navigate as a business travel company during the pandemic, right? It must have been a lot smooth sailing, a lot of fun, easy times, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, lots of easy times. It was absolutely wild. I remember the board meeting in March when the pandemic was really starting to hit. And we had the board meeting in person. And we were all kind of sitting there and we're like, should we be doing this? You know, remember that weird time right at the beginning of the pandemic where we're all like, you know, I don't really quite know what we should be doing here. And it was wild because we were showing this chart. We were showing the last quarter and it was the best sales quarter ever. We closed a couple million dollars of business in a single quarter. We were super proud of those results. And then the next slide showed like revenue falling off of a cliff, like literally going from to 5% what it was the month previous, because we were a transactional business. We charge our customers per trip. And it was just this crazy juxtaposition where we were at such an amazing point of the company's growth. We were really hitting our product market fit curve, and the pandemic really stopped us. And I think, you know, probably the smartest thing that we did in executing our response to the pandemic is we assumed that it was going to be worse rather than assuming that it was going to be better. And we made some pretty deep cuts to personnel, to spending right after the pandemic hit, because the mindset that we were operating in is if we were pessimistic and, you know, the pandemic recovery looked better than what we expected it to, we could start reinvesting. And that's always a better place to come from rather than a place from cutting, from a place from growing. And I'm really glad that we did that. And in fact, our sale to Coupa had nothing to do with cash. We actually had cash to make it through the pandemic. And kind of looking at what recovery curves look now, I think we would have made it. But, you know, the offer from Coupa was just too great, and the synergies just made too much sense.
That's awesome. And Devin, the other question I had for you, I mean, I've known you for a while, and one of the things I've admired most about you is just your grit and your optimism in the face of challenges. And I know a little bit of the story of Panna. I mean, you went through a few twists and turns with pivoting the business, and we'd just love to hear a little bit about that.
I like the positive spin of grit. The negative spin could be wandering around in the dark for a while and not finding product market fit, which, you know, I think is the untold chapter of a lot of companies. You know, no one ever talks about Airbnb in the days when they thought that you literally had to have an air mattress. They were turning away people from the platform who had guest bedrooms that they wanted to rent. They thought you literally had to have an air mattress because it was Airbnb and you had to serve breakfast. And you know, there was so much of a market that they weren't tapping into because they were so steadfast on that. But yeah, we definitely went through a lot of those similar learnings in the early stages of the business. We started out thinking that we were going to be a service for small and medium. Actually, we thought we were going to be a service for consumers at the beginning, really learned that at that point we would be competing with Priceline and Expedia, who, you know, collectively those two companies make up about 5% of Google's ad revenue. And so the leisure travel space really is just this gigantic ad conversion funnel. And so we pivoted from that business, pivoted into working with small and medium-sized businesses on their travel, and learned that we were still competing in the same space. Small and medium-sized businesses book their travel exactly like consumers do. They go on Priceline and they go on Expedia. It wasn't until a lot of painful learnings and a lot of capital that we really learned that the true market opportunity for us was in the corporate enterprise travel space.
Great. So, you know, Devin, you're a Denver native. Would love to hear your perspective on, you know, the Denver tech scene now and how you've seen it evolve over the last several years.
I absolutely love the Denver tech scene. You know, when I graduated from CU, Sam and I were really trying to make the decision of where do we start this business. And we were considering the Bay Area, but it felt a little bit like moving to Hollywood to become an actor. And the other thing that you get here in the Denver tech scene that you don't get really in any other tech scene that I've seen, that I think was really pioneered by Cohen and the folks at Techstars, is this give first mentality that's just pervasive across the entire scene. I mean, you can meet with competitors and spend an hour sharing industry facts, ideas, thoughts, tips. And there's just a feeling here in the tech scene that all boats rise. And as the tech scene's gotten bigger and bigger, I'm just really glad that we've retained that. I hope that we always retain that element. But you asked also, what's the biggest thing that's changed? And I think the biggest thing that's changed is there's just so much more capital here, which I'm super excited about. You know, a bunch of seed funds have started here, and a bunch of Series A funds are really looking at this market as a big opportunity. And I just think that that's really exciting, and it's going to mean that this industry is going to grow a ton.
Yep. Yeah, is a relatively new transplant to Denver. I think, you know, what you mentioned about the give first mentality and sort of the collaborative nature of everyone was immediately clear to me as soon as I got here, from, you know, people being willing to make connections and how welcoming. And to your point, you know, that collaboration, I think, helps everyone get better faster than if everyone was doing it on their own. And I think that that's going to be a big driver of Denver's success long term. So, Devin, shifting to why we're here and your biggest lesson, I'm sure over the course of building, running, and selling Panda that you've learned a bunch of different lessons. But we'd love to dive in and learn what your biggest lesson was during that journey.
Yeah, definitely. So I think my journey on this biggest lesson started in 2016 when the New York Times published an article called What Google Learned from Its Quest to Build a Perfect Team. And of course, like, super hyperbolic description of an article, but I read it and found it interesting. And one of the things that the article was talking about, or the core concept of the article, was this research study that Google did called Project Aristotle. And Project Aristotle looked at, you know, like 5,000 different teams across Google and tried to understand what made teams most effective. Tons of really interesting things came out of the research study, but I thought the most interesting one was that there's kind of this Maslow's hierarchy of needs for teams. And at the base of that, for a team to be successful, they need to have this thing that Google was calling psychological safety, which essentially meant, in their definition, was that a team felt comfortable to make mistakes, ask questions, look foolish, really be vulnerable in front of each other. And at the time, I was like, okay, this is an interesting concept. I kind of get it. I know that when teams trust each other, they work more effectively. But it wasn't, that was really at the very beginning of Panna. And it wasn't started until we started building the team to 20 people, to 30 people, to 40 people, that I really realized that psychological safety, or, you know, I think can be shortened down to just safety, team members feeling like they can be vulnerable to each other, in my mind, is the single largest determinant of success for teams. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about why trust matters so much. And I think that really what it comes down for me is because when teams don't trust each other, when people don't feel like they're in a safe environment, that breeds, I think, the antithesis to productivity and success at business, which has a bunch of different names, but you can call it politics, you can call it drama, but politics and drama kills businesses and kills productivity. And not only that, it makes it not fun to come to work. And, you know, all the symptoms of do you have politics at work or do you have drama at work are when you start seeing finger pointing, when you start seeing people covering up mistakes, we start seeing people, you know, doing CYA activities such as like hedging their bets and things like that. All of this stuff just like kills what would have been a great company or a highly productive team and makes it impossible to be successful. So that's why, in my mind, building a environment that's safe, where people trust each other, it being the single most important determinant of business success is probably my biggest lesson.
That makes sense. It sounds like the article was something that highlighted that and got you thinking about it. I've often seen that people who really sort of, you know, codify something as their biggest lesson have not only read about it, but they have some very clear, memorable experiences of times when it both went well, and it led to great outcomes, and times when it went really poorly, and you're like, I have to fix that, or I have to solve that. Would love to hear one example from each of maybe a time when that didn't happen and it caused some problems or some failures, and another time when that type of culture led to a big success or a big win for you and your team.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think when I really started noticing that this was important and this was a problem when we started getting on our hyperscaling journey at Panna, and our leadership team started growing. I ran as CEO a weekly Monday leadership meeting where really my goal for that meeting, and I said this over and over again, is I want to talk about what's broken in the business. I want to talk about the problems, and let's as a group collaboratively work on those problems. You know, look at all of the key projects that we had. We had a nice, you know, dashboard that I asked everyone to update, you know, as yellow, green, or red. And I didn't want to talk about the greens. You know, we had time to talk about greens. I wanted to talk about the yellows and the reds. And I wanted to use the collective brain power of all these smart people that I hired to start solving those problems. And I was sitting in one of these leadership meetings, and we were talking about a red project. I think it was some sort of like sales target that we weren't hitting. And the conversation was ridiculous. First of all, we were wildly off from this target, and none of my leadership team was saying anything. My engineering leaders weren't saying anything. Product leaders weren't saying anything. Operations leaders weren't saying anything. And you know, we were having this conversation, and we were kind of beating around the bush that like this wasn't working and the approach. But instead, I was just kind of getting all of these non-answers from the team. And I'm like, what is going on? Like, we all know that there's a problem in this business. How do we collaboratively work together to solve this problem? What are all the ideas that all these people, you know, sure, product leaders and engineering leaders, they don't work in sales, but they have interesting ideas. They can look at a project through a new lens, and we weren't getting any engagement. And it wasn't until a lot of executive coaching and a lot of reading and a lot of reflection on how I had structured those teams and structured that meeting is that no one felt safe in that meeting. My sales leader didn't feel safe to say, I don't really know what's going on. You know, guys, I need help. You know, what ideas do you have? And my other leaders didn't feel safe holding their peers accountable. Instead, they were worried about risking the relationship. And so what we did was we spent a ton of time working on building two muscles on the team. And I think that these two muscles really are how you build psychological safety. The first muscle is trust, building authentic relationships where you trust each other and feel safe in front of each other. And then the second muscle, and these are mutually reinforcing, is candor. Building a culture where you know that everyone is going to be saying what they mean and not holding something back. And the super important thing about building a trust of a culture of candor is that then there's no, you know, there's no subtext. There's no the thing that someone isn't saying. All cards are on the table. So we are not playing poker with each other. You're transparent with each other. And both of those elements are super important, because if you have candor without trust, you get what's called the obnoxious asshole syndrome, where, you know, you have someone who's being honest and being obnoxious and being, you know, calling people out, but not doing that from a place of care, not doing that from a place of, I want these people and this business to be successful, just from a place of wanting to be right. And I think it would only be fair if I'm using these words to call out, you know, another one of my favorite books where really these words started being codified for me, which is A Radical Candor by Kim Scott. A fantastic book that talks about the relationship between trust and candor, and really a framework that we started teaching everyone. Put words to what can kind of feel like a touchy-feely or nebulous concept.
I think it can be hugely valuable, and I've seen it done really well, but I've also seen the concept of radical candor be used as a license to be an asshole. So I'd love to hear how you got the good things that come with radical candor in your organization and prevented the, I'm using radical candor as an acceptable way to be an asshole.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think just one of the biggest fundamental misunderstandings about the radical framework is that it is a license to be an obnoxious asshole. There's nothing productive about that. And I think the most important piece of coaching on that framework is helping people understand that this needs to come from a place of caring personally. And so what we ask people to do is ask, like, when you're providing this feedback, are you providing this feedback because you want to see the person that you're providing feedback to get better or be more successful in some way? Is this coming from a place of personal care for that other person? Or is this coming from a place because you're pissed or you're angry or you think you're right? And if it's coming from the latter place, it's not useful and doesn't have a place in the company. But if it is coming from a place of personal care, then it is useful. And one of the other frameworks or ways of thinking that we ask people to think about when they're giving feedback is recognizing that this feedback is coming from a place of your perspective. Your story is one of the words that we've started using at our company to talk about, you know, what this is, which is true. You know, every single one of our perceptions and our thoughts and our interactions is our perception of what's going on in the situation. We could be completely wrong. And I often find that when you come at feedback from that perspective of, hey, like, I'm seeing this thing happening, I could be totally wrong, but I want to share with you my perspective on, you know, what I think might be going wrong or some feedback that I have from you. And it's your choice to take it or leave it. I think that place of humility just turns feedback on its head. It's like, I could be wrong. I could be being an obnoxious asshole right now. And if you've ever been on the other side of receiving feedback like that, it just feels so much better.
Devin, I totally agree. And one of the things that I was struck by that you said that really, you know, fits with my experience is the fact that if you just leave it alone, right? If you just leave people to their own devices, particularly fast growing organizations, there will be politics and people will be cautious. And it's something that you have to really, really spend a lot of proactive effort to manage. Wondering what your take is on that, and maybe some advice to other startups that might say, hey, like, I'm not a political person, right? I trust everybody. I'm going to give feedback. Can't I just lead by example and everyone's just going to do the same thing?
You're absolutely right. There's politics entropy that occurs where, you know, you drag yourself into this drama and don't even realize that you're being dragged into this drama. And I think really the first step is acknowledging that it exists and acknowledging that you are guilty of it as well. And so I think you said, can't I just lead by example? Yes, I think that's important, but I think people don't do that because they say politics doesn't exist here. We're a small company. That would never happen here, but it does. It happens in every company, even the company that has, you know, the best company culture. Leaders make mistakes. People make mistakes. Culture is not about people flawlessly executing that culture every single time. It's about nudging people correctively towards the culture that you're looking for when you see mistakes in that culture. And so, you know, I do think that so step one, just to summarize, step one is being conscious that it's going to happen in your company. Step two, I think, is demonstrating that vulnerability as a leader, demonstrating, you know, the ability to make mistakes, admit those mistakes. And then I think step three, though, is virtue signaling when others exhibit the same behavior, really rewarding those behaviors publicly. Like, and one of the ways that we did that, Panna, is we had team rituals exercise that we did at the end of every week. And we went around and we did this even when we really shouldn't have all fit in the same room. We packed everyone into the same room and you know, made this possible. But we would go around and ask a couple questions. And one of the questions that we would ask is, what was your biggest fail of the week? What was the biggest mistake that you made? And everyone would go around and talk about, like, I pushed this bug to production and like 15 customers got angry. Or like, you know, I totally had this miscalculation in our financials where I thought we were going to make $1 million extra this year that we're not going to make. And we have to figure out how we make that up. And when like the CFO demonstrated vulnerably and the head of product demonstrated vulnerability, and there was this positive environment where it felt safe to admit mistakes and sunshine those and figure out how we solve those. Having those rituals built into the fabric of culture so that they're automatic. You do them every single week. You don't even realize why they're happening or what they're reinforcing. That's probably my biggest tip or advice for founders trying to create a similar environment.
That is awesome. And I love that exercise at the end of the week. That's phenomenal. Just a way to like completely force vulnerability. I can just imagine those discussions.
Totally.
I have to ask one more question though, which is the reverse of that. Did you ever have a situation where people, despite your best efforts, we're still playing politics, we're still doing some of the behavior that we're now standing out like a sore thumb when everyone else is displaying trust and vulnerability? Did you have that experience? And if so, how'd you deal with it?
Absolutely. And, I think ultimately, I very much believe what I said earlier, which is that culture isn't about, and core values isn't about flawlessly executing those core values every single time. Like, people are going to make mistakes. I'm going to make mistakes, and we want to correct those. But when you do see a repeated pattern of not understanding the culture that we're trying to build, and after receiving feedback multiple times, if you still have a problem, I think the other way that you reinforce your culture and reinforce your core values is you hire and fire by them. And so we have removed people from the organization based upon their inability to create psychological safety across the organization. And, we could probably have an entire extra podcast on firing and what to do there. But I think my belief in candor extends to the firing process as well. You don't need to go into the gory details with everyone so that, on why this person wasn't a fit. But I do think you need to be candid and honest around why this person, when people showed up on Monday, doesn't work there anymore. Because that, when someone gets fired, that's a place where psychological safety could be broken. If they don't understand, if it feels unsafe that like you do something, you speak out and then you disappear, on Monday, that damages psychological safety too. So I think you have to point at like, look, this person over the course of 6 months received a lot of coaching in this area and just couldn't adapt to the work environment that we wanted to create.
Devin, that's phenomenal. And particularly just love how tactical you were at Panna around creating that environment. Clearly was, part of the key to why you guys were able to be so successful. So thanks for that. How can listeners get in touch with you or follow what you're up to?
Ooh, that's a great question. Kind of hard to keep in touch with. I don't really use social media. I'm not on Twitter. But if anyone does have a question on anything that we've talked about today, or just wants to chat about building a company, I work at a big company now. I've got a regular job. Work hard, but love spending time with founders, and it really energizes me when I do get to talk to founders. So they can just contact me via email. My email is just myfirstname@mylastname.me. I would love to get in touch with anyone who's building a business here in Colorado or in any market.
Great, Devin. Thanks so much for your time today. Really, really appreciate it and learned a lot.
Absolutely.